Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted,
the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat.
Welcome to episode 159 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander. So, announcements this week. Ginger, what are our announcements this week?
What are some things? Well, okay, like we used to do old school, or Outlander pod old school, is when we first started, of course, like the latest casting news or some, you know, some article that was written. Of course, this is before the preponderance of or the appearance of a majillion fan sites, which God bless them. We love them. And look, we don't have to do that anymore. Number one, we don't have to. Number two, we can't. There is too much to cover and you guys do it so well. We leave it to y'all.
However, because I kind of look at our episodes going back, if you go back and listen to them from the beginning, almost like a time capsule. Because it's kind of like we give you the idea of where we were in that time and you kind of get a sense of the excitement of everything building. And looking back, you can say, oh, that was the week that so-and-so was announced as casting or whatever. So I think we would be remiss to not have a casting notice for Mr. Lord John Grey.
Holy crap. What are you talking about? I can't believe I totally forgot that.
I know. I saw you forgetting it. So I was like, "That's I'm going to have to mention that because it was big.
So rewind. So, announcements this week.
Australian actor David Barry has been cast as Lord John Grey.
Oh my gosh.
He's so real many, hot, you guys.
So many fantasies have just popped out. There were already like fantasies of the whole LJG kind of thing going on, whatever. But oh my goodness. I just thought of like, we're not going to give spoilers, but I just went straight to Moby. And you know what I'm talking about. Oh no, Echo. Sorry. I went straight to late Echo. I was like, oh my God. Dude. Claire.
Right now. It's like that moment where you're like, Katrina, you just got a gift. You got a gift, my friend. We all got gifts.
She got a gift in Stanley.
I mean, awesome sparring partner, like a great scene partner for sure. And she's getting a delightful gift in Mr. David Barry.
And so is, I almost said, so is Johnny. There's no Johnny.
Jamie. Yeah.
Yeah, this whole David Barry thing obviously has shaken me up because I can't speak clearly. Any other announcements? I mean, that obviously is a big one. There's all kinds of tweeting because, oh, well, we will come back to announcements. But the reason we missed last week is because Pod Studio, as it was, Shea Pod, changed to Shea Pod and Shea Pod. So we have now split the merging. I think it was on Friends or something. I don't know. There's the merging of the things and then the dividing of the things or the splitting or whatever. And so we've been splitting of the things and returning to our own households, which we were before, Casa Pod. I'm like, how many synonyms can I come up with in the last like minute? There's two Casa Pods or Casas Pod, however you say that, or Shea Pod.
I wouldn't know.
So we split the things and Summer's Casa Pod kept the TARDIS. So we'll be doing...
You say kept. I say was gifted with.
Oh, gifted.
You didn't have room for it.
Oh, my Lord. That's true.
I was pretty much told I had to take it.
Well, we could have like sold it or given it away or put it in the storage, but that I was not going to...
I'm not, so sad.
I'm not giving it away to no Tom, Dick, or Harry stranger. I mean, maybe... Okay, I'm not going to go any further. No. So definitely Summer's Place is bigger. So there's that. I literally wouldn't have had room. Yes. But it also makes it a little bit easier since she does have a child that when we do recordings, which will probably be the rule rather than the exception. For interviews and such, we absolutely must be together because we have to have the same mic for the setup. But for normal read-alongs, if something happens and you know someone can't make it over or whatever, we do have a setup so we can record from our different homes and both of us recording on our side and get all, you know, using the magic of Dropbox and all that, we can get it done. But the idea of the TARDIS was to have like a one-stop shop.
Well, the idea behind the TARDIS, and I'm sure we'll provide more photos for you. The idea behind the TARDIS in the first place was that every week we have to break down the studio because of Ginger's cats. I mean, that's the honest to God truth. Her cats are cable. Well, one is a cable chewer.
Couscous. I love my baby Goose, but holy, oh my gosh. I still tell her, and she's almost nine. I still tell her, honey, baby, you are so lucky that I was the one who adopted you, because I don't even know about, can't speak for summer, although I can guess so many other people who would have adopted this cat
would have murdered her. I want you to know.
No, would have taken her back. Like, look, I got to surrender you.
The things that I've discovered in my move.
Don't make me spit my water out on my phone.
I went to, okay, I have a large TV in my bedroom that lives in a TV armoire kind of thing. And I haven't.
This episode is how to not murder your cat.
And I don't think I've ever looked at the cable, the power cable that goes to it.
Because you assumed, why?
Well, why would I?
That's right? What I mean.
So I went to plug it in because it had been disassembled and stuff and reassembled. And I went to go set the whole thing up in my bedroom. And the power cable, I don't know how it still works. Like, it has the amount of chewing on
this
cable.
The cable has been raped.
It has been assaulted for sure.
That's probably not very sensitive of me.
It was assaulted.
It was brutalized.
It was for sure. And I was just like, okay, well, as soon as this cable dies, I'm going to be coming to you.
I'm done with cables.
Anywho, so because of the cats and the chewing, every week we had to break down
and also lock the door while we recorded to keep the cat out
and start all over again. I mean, every week we'd have to get things back out, check levels. And I mean, we're always going to check levels because that's just what you do. But this way,
it was annoying.
With the TARDIS, we don't have to do that. And because it is a closing desk
and the way it's set up, and we haven't even loaded it yet with everything, but or moved into the TARDIS completely. But the way it is set up or will be set up is that it literally will look bigger on the inside than the outside. It's amazing this all the stuff that we'll be able to fit in here.
For sure.
So the original intent, as Summer said, was to have a place to not just keep it set up, but also protect it. So that's still the case. And even though at this point, Summer's Casa Pod does not have a cat of any kind, and that may be something she may want to consider.
The only animal at present is my critter.
Which is enough for
now. Which is an 8-year-old little girl who does not chew cables as of yet, but thank it could goodness. Always start. You never
it
know.
It always happen. So for now, we are still going to record in the same, we'll always record together, but we're still aiming to go in the same, literally at the TARDIS, almost in the TARDIS, well, kind of like halfway in the TARDIS, and then maybe the odd recording separately. So we are trying out all kinds of new things, and it'll be fun. So I detoured from the announcements to say kind of why we've been away for 2 weeks, even though we've already said it a few times. We were both moving house and both setting up our new studios, because Summer has probably the main pod studio with the TARDIS, but I have to have a working studio at home so I can record from home if I need to. And even though I don't have a TARDIS, I do have an armoire that I will be able to, I'm still getting the kinks out of it, I'll be able to close up to save cables from said cat. Because I'm the person who believes that when you adopt an animal, it is for life. Yours, whichever ends first. I'm just kidding. If the other one ends, huh? No, just kidding. So I keep her. She's one of my baby girls. So I have to protect the cables from her. And I'm doing a lot of cat proofing right now, which is really stressful for me and them.
Seriously, so, I don't know how she hasn't electrocuted herself.
That's the whole thing that everybody is wondering about. How the heck? She's destroyed at least two of Summer's cables, one of your phone and then one of your TV. Well, the TV is on its last legs, but we'll find out. She definitely destroyed one of my cables, which may not have been new, but it went to my new monitor from last fall. So, of course, if you don't have a working monitor, oopsie, you have no computer. You can't use your computer. I don't have a little thing to plug it into.
Right.
And she's destroyed a few of my other cables along the years, which are not as important, but yeah. So, I love her to death, but she does test me and try me sometimes. So while we've been gone, there's been the announcement of David Barry as Lord John Grey. That's the only announcement, right? But they have started filming. I think they started even before we took off, but it was very recent. Sam's been tweeting about that. Meryl's been tweeting about that. Matt's been tweeting about that. There's been a lot of tweeting about and a lot of pictures. Again, no spoilers. We already knew what happened or was about to happen at the end of season two. Culloden was filmed. That's pretty much a given. Well, they have all kinds of pictures from it.
It was it was all pictures of a bloody Sam.
No, but there was pictures of lines of troops.
Yes, but the only ones I remember are the ones of bloody Sam.
Okay, so then there's that. And then, of course, today there was well, the day we're recording this, Sunday, September 4th, there was ScottCon in Edinburgh. And we of course, would have loved to have been there. It just, there was just not a way. But our good friend Stephanie McGuckin agreed to help us out. So we worked with ScottCon reps and Stephanie, and she was able to basically be our correspondent. And she did a Twitter and Instagram takeover.
She did. And she is also kind of has her own little notoriety as one of the outlandish bakers. Right.
She's one of the... Yeah, she's one of the bakers.
And the peanut butter cookies that Sam loves are really, really, really good.
They are really good. They weren't so gluten-free, were they? I don't remember.
No, I think the muffins were gluten-free, okay. And those were for Kate,
oh
I believe.
Oh my gosh, but everything there was really good. And everything that we had of hers last year was really good. So if you haven't had a chance, then do take a peek at our Twitter feed. It's twitter.com/outlanderpod, as well as our Instagram feed, instagram.com/outlanderpod. And take a look at all, I mean, I'm still kind of going through our own timeline going, oh, that's right, I missed it. You know, it's so funny when, and this is the first time, it was, you know, she didn't ask, we offered, but it was something to me, it just made sense. It would be so much easier than her doing it on her own timeline and then us, you know,
retweeting everything.
I'm not going to get up at 4 a.m. or 3 a.m. and do it and follow her for 5 hours. I'm still unpacking and then prepping and now recording. It's not going to happen. So we're just like, you know, we know you, we trust you, just do it and get us as much as you can. And even if it's not a lot, it's still great. But she was able to get quite a bit.
So clearly all you have to do to gain our trust is make amazing peanut butter cookies.
No, much more than
and
that.
And take us to fun places.
We've known her for about 2 years now. So yeah. No, it's much more than that. But she was really great. So again, Stephanie, thank you so, so much. And as Summer said,
she's our special pod correspondent.
Oh, she is. She's our first. We've had people who have brought us stuff or, you know, shared information with us from events. But this was straight up correspondent. Mm-hmm. I mean, this was a takeover. We've never had that. And I don't think prior to the last few months, I would have even considered it.
Y'all.
You know how controlling I am.
Summer. Okay. This is Summer speaking. I don't even have the passwords to any of the sites. I want to put that out there. She won't give them to me.
I set it up on your phone.
She set it up on my phone and signed it in, but I do not have the passwords to go into any of these things on my own. So if that gives you any idea of how controlling Ms. Ginger is with all of our accounts, then you know that this is a huge deal. A huge deal for her to share this information with anyone else. And I don't even have that privilege.
Don't worry, the password will be changed back very soon.
That's what I thought.
But no, but I wanted to leave it open in case she has any like little follow-ups or anything.
Oh, for sure.
Okay, so...
So I'm anticipating some audio tidbits coming back from Scotty.
From ScottyCon. Now from Summer's
from ScottCon, because we are a podcast, and she knows.
She did get a few audio sound bites, which we'll be sharing in future episodes, hopefully next week. One of the benefits or perks of being part of our Facebook community is just the random... Not so random, because it's all somehow... at least tangentially related to Outlander, but the most ridiculous and funny and random things pop up. Now, if you haven't joined us yet, of course, we would love to have you. You can join our group at outlanderpod.com/group. And one of those random and hysterical things that just popped up this week was shared by member Marnie. And it was an article. And she said, basically, take a look at number 8. So this article is from self.com. We will link to it in the show notes. It's called 8 Books with Insanely Hot Sex Scenes That Are Better Than Porn. And that's pretty much all I'm going to say. And you go down. It has a list of books, blah, blah, blah. Number 8, Outlander by Diana Gabaldone.
Now, I was looking through the list after you tagged me in that. And I was looking through the list and I have read exactly one of the books on that
Outlander?
List. No. Okay, then 2. One other than Outlander.
It's like, I hope you've read at least one.
One other than Outlander. And if nothing else, it just literally gave me a list of things I need to go and read now. Is that weird and gross? I kind of feel like I
don't think it's weird and gross, but it's like this article motivated you.
Well, it's I want to know how these other ones stand up to the others. I'm like, well, I mean, I've read Outlander. I think it's pretty hot. But... she's not real specific. I mean, I don't think that she's real, like, descriptive, if you will. One of the other one I read was the Bared to You by, I think, Sylvia Day. I think I read that one. And I don't remember what series that was based on, but I'm pretty sure I read all of the books in that series. But there's a bunch of books in there that I have not read, and there's only 8 of them, and so that means there's 6. So 6 That's is true. A bunch. That would take a lot of time. However, I may take one for the team and let you know.
Or
and
maybe,
I may,
or maybe and, not let us know.
And I may rank them a little bit differently. I'm just saying.
Though I'm so- oh, if you're going to do that, that would be an interesting little report. You have to read all of them then.
Okay, I'll read them all.
All. Okay, so I think without further ado, is that kind of the end of our little official, unofficial announcements and funny stuff? Is there anything else that we need to mention or forgot to mention?
I mean, that's all I can think of right now. So that is announcements, which means it is time to move on to our read-along. This week, we will be discussing part 2. We begin part 2, I should say. Part 2 is entitled Lallybroch. And chapter 4 is entitled The Dunbonnet. And can I just reiterate how glad I am we're no longer in France?
Chapter 4. Connie S. gives us a little bit of a description of the word dun. To break this term down, which I almost said Betsy. I don't know who the heck, but please stay with me. I am having trouble the last like week. I don't know if it's a lack of sleep or stress from moving, but just bear with me. Not Betsy, Brianna. Brianna was telling us a little bit about that dull brown bonnet. And Connie gives us a little bit more information. The word is dun. It's an adjective. It means dull grayish brown, but it also means dark and gloomy. Now, before we go on, was there any description? I know in the sense of the title, the dunbonnet means the dude who's known as the dunbonnet, right? Not the actual thing he wore.
Right. But a dunbonnet is just a brown hat, is it not?
But it wasn't mentioned at all. The whole chapter is about the dude. Well, Jamie.
The whole chapter is about Jamie.
But we don't hear about his bonnet is what I'm saying. We don't hear about his hat.
No.
That's all I'm asking. Okay. Don't get ahead. Because I know you want to. We all want to talk about it. Okay. Michael M. writes, the dunbonnet makes me think more of Brianna than of Jamie. It was Brianna that first posed that Jamie was the dunbonnet as evidence of his whereabouts after Culloden. It is in Brianna's telling of the story, then later on her hearing more about the dunbonnet from Fiona, that I believe this is Bree's first connection to Jamie and her first admiration of him. Now that's getting a tiny bit ahead because we haven't gotten to the part, right, where Fiona has shared more? Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. But it's not like a spoiler that
no, but
me talking about Moby.
No, I feel like this is almost the confirmation chapter.
Oh, yeah.
Where they have this hypothesis that they've created based on the findings they found in that book with the Highland Tale of the Dunbonnet. And this chapter is the verification of that.
Now, not always does Diana give us exact times or locations, but she often gives us some variation of that. Here, it is at Lallybroch, and it is November 1752. Now, this is about 6.5 years after Culloden.
Right. And that's, I think, why it's important that she gave us the time period.
Oh, yeah.
Because it kind of gives us you an idea of how long he's been doing this.
And how much longer approximately he has.
To keep doing this?
Well, because she said, we've been told 7 years, haven't we? Didn't they say 7 years? Or am I just, I know I'm not making the number up. I'm not sure if Brianna's story had the 7 years in it. But it's seven. It's not, I'm not really spoiling much here. Donna Kay writes, it has been 6.5 years since Culloden and Brianna was right. Jamie has literally been living in a cave all this time. This is really the beginning of the end of his time as the Dunbonnet. However, I have to say that until this reading, I never really understood or paid attention to the absolute devastating loneliness, desolation, and descent into an animal-like existence that Jamie experienced post-Culloden. Diana wrote in great detail about it. Life as he knew it was gone. So the heading here puts us in the 18th century. This is back in my voice now as Ginger, almost 6.5 years after Culloden, and Jamie's at Lallybroch. So this alone tells us that he's still alive and that he made it home successfully in that wagon with that bad wound. We get a beautifully tragic and horrible description of the transformation of Jamie Fraser. There's the Jamie we knew with Claire, Then there's the Jamie after Claire, during and just post Culloden. Now, almost 7 years later, this is a Jamie in hiding. This is animal Jamie. Quote, he came down to the house, unquote. So he was probably somewhere outside of the house, presumably a bit of a ways, since someone had to bring him word it was okay to return. So this is almost 7 years, and the Scots are still feeling the effects and terror of the aftermath of Culloden, and he can only come to the house at night.
I'm just imagining to myself how you would survive in a cave by yourself. You
compared with you?
Yeah, I'm cool with being quiet. You, however, are not, my friend. You need someone to constantly listen to you for verification. Like,
this is really funny because I'm like the most noise sensitive person I know. Mm-hmm. Yet I talk like a talker.
Right.
I mean,
I know. That's what I'm saying. I'm trying to imagine how you would fare.
I would be
that crazy person talking to a volleyball in Castaway.
Well, I'd be talking to myself, which I guess I could project, but I would definitely like, what's the term? Disassociate or no, not dissociate. My mind would break. I would have multiple personalities because I would need to entertain myself.
You would need someone to talk to, so you'd create it.
Sybil. The entire description of Jamie here is of some animal or some wraith. Quote, he would slip like a shadow through the kitchen door to be met with Ian's smile or his sister's kiss and would feel the transformation begin, unquote. So perhaps I got the image of like a were animal, you know, like he would shed his beast as he got closer to the house. And mm-hmm. then after everything was done and he returned to the cave, he would go into his beast again or shed his humanity.
And it was a monthly process as well.
Oh, Lord have mercy.
I'm not saying it was lunar. I'm just saying it was monthly.
Holy crapoli.
It was
That's
cyclical.
Funny. No, it's cyclical can be every 6 months. Cyclical is just on a schedule.
It is. I'm just saying.
Girlfriend.
He said every once a month.
I know. That is cyclical, but that's not the important part. The fact that you said once a month. Holy kajoke. That's funny. It's like, that you thought that and, well, not thought that, brought it up. And then I thought, we're animal. Ah, okay.
It's like Jamie's monthly.
Oh my God. Summer.
Only he shaves instead of bleeding.
Diana describes the items laid out. There's a basin of hot water, a freshly stropped razor, and whatever was being used for shaving soap. Quote, now and then it was real soap if Cousin Jared has sent some from France, unquote. So this made me think more about Jared. Jared, who would have fully supported his nephew's turn as Jacobite Laird and leader at Culloden, is still sitting pretty in France to some extent. He's sitting not in hiding, at least. Now, I wonder how he feels right about now. Does he think Jamie is dead? Certainly he doesn't know that he's hiding because that would put even him in danger. But, you know, Jared, whom we all kind of liked, except maybe till the end of book two, I'm not a big fan of Jared's right now.
Because he doesn't always send him soap?
Some. No, Jared was a big push of the...
of the Jacobite Rebellion?
Yes. But sorry, that's... anyway, so more on the transformation. Quote, he could feel the change begin with the first scent of the kitchen, unquote. That's more support for the whole animal. Diana mentions it, so you don't need to like read into it. It's an animal versus human, or lack of humanity versus gaining your humanity or civilized humanity as you get toward the house and toward your family. So poor Jamie, we are to assume that this was his habit ever since returning to Lallybroch, an animal in hiding for almost 7 years.
I can't even imagine that.
I can't imagine it. I think like for one night, not even a week, for one night, maybe two nights.
Oh, I could go for weeks at a time. I couldn't go for
in
years.
In a cave? That you have to like sideways shimmy
into? In complete solitude, like just quiet, alone with my own thoughts and just like being and not having societal pressures and just, you know. I'm just saying, I could probably do it for like a few weeks or like maybe a month, but I don't know that I could do it for 7 years.
Ellen G. writes, there is a story in the Jewish tradition that begins with a man roughed up by his work week walking home like a dog Friday afternoon. As he walks into his home, he is turned back into the, quote, man he really is to celebrate Shabbat from Friday night through Saturday night. This next paragraph reminds me of the story, and that is a paragraph where Diana finishes with, quote, it wasn't until he had finished the ritual of shaving that he felt himself altogether human once more, unquote. There are lots of references to animal, human, animal versus human, light, dark, all that kind of thing. He came up to the house only once. Some already said this, but this is where it comes up in the chapter. He came up to the house only once every freaking month.
Yeah, for like not even a whole day.
Like maybe an hour max. Yeah, maybe 2 hours.
Just enough time to shave and eat a meal and hear the happenings. And then he was like,
Good Lord.
Back to my cave.
It was hard for him to speak right away after being alone and probably not speaking, of course, for so long.
Well, he said it was a log jam. Like, it was like he had so many things to say, he didn't know where to start.
Yeah.
Because he has a month of like
feelings,
repressed,
and thoughts.
Repressed. Because
everything.
You don't need to speak out loud if you're by yourself because everything kind of goes on in your head. You're just whatever. So him needing to use those muscles to communicate to everyone, he's just like, I don't know where to start.
And quote, in the short time he had, unquote, it was hard for him to speak right away after being alone for so long. And also in the short time that he had, as Diana writes, even after 1 month, he didn't have much time at the house with other humans for socialization to return to himself. So he already wasn't himself out there, and he comes to himself, to his family, to his actual, what he was meant to be. But he has such a short time, he can't even do that right. When he is able to come back to society, or to at least humanity. He used this time to get news about English patrols, politics, arrests and trials in London and Edinburgh. But he started with estate matters with Ian and the children with Jenny. If it seemed safe, now how sad is this? If it seemed safe, the kids would be brought down to say hello to their uncle and then return to bed. So it was already just flat out not safe. But they were willing to risk it for once a month for him to come in, you know, give him good food and to check in, make sure he's alive, he's okay. But that means that I'm guessing if they were able to do it every single time, I don't think Diana would have written that. So to me, what that means is there were times when the kids may have gone months without seeing their uncle, because only if it was safe would they be brought down from bed, woken up, brought down, and then returned to bed.
What would make it safe versus not safe? Because maybe someone, if it wasn't safe, why would he be coming down at all?
He wouldn't be coming. I see what you're saying. Because he wouldn't be coming down unless it were safe.
Right.
Because the boys, or a boy, Fergus, was only if it was safe, I use air quotes, was he allowed to go down and tell Jamie it was safe. So yeah, I see what you're saying. If it was safe enough for them to tell him, for him to come, why would it not be safe enough for them to come? So I don't know. But there had to be a dichotomy there, because Diane is telling us he is there and sometimes it's not safe enough for them to come down. So it had to, I don't know what would make it not safe, but that condition had to exist at some point, because Diana just stated it did. Ellen G writes, even though he is in hiding, he knows what is happening on his estate and to his people. So yeah, this shows that Jamie is doing his best with the limited resources and time and everything that he has to stay abreast of what is going on. Young Jamie is growing up, and we find Ian has been arrested for the fourth time and taken to Inverness on suspicion of being a Jacobite sympathizer. I mean, holy heck, just imagine Jenny right now. Maybe not the fourth time, because she seemed kind of, not flippant, but kind of like, oh yeah, you know, we'll see him in a few weeks or he'll be back. But can you imagine like the first time this happened? Thank God her brother didn't die, but her brother's practically dead. Mm-hmm. Her sister-in-law's gone and her brother's in hiding. And if he gets in trouble, the whole family could be in trouble for hiding him.
Well, because,
and then Ian disappears. Can you imagine?
Right. And the forethought that went into deeding this property to young Jamie and not to Ian. I mean, to have that kind of forethought is also
crazy.
It's crazy, but it's something that's indicative of the character of Jamie Fraser. Jamie.
Absolutely. But I can't imagine Jenny the very first time Ian gets taken away. But the fourth time she's like, oh my God, okay, he'll be back. You know, he's just...
Well, and then the talking about...
They have like a pattern
about the
now.
Deed of sassing being like, or sazing. I already forgot how to pronounce it, even though they had it in that episode. And I was like, finally, I know how they pronounce it.
And now...
I know, I've forgotten.
You're slacking.
I am totally slacking. But
you had one job.
I've had many jobs.
Not for this podcast.
I guess that's true.
I was totally being facetious, but it's totally true. It's true. I'm just kidding. That's because I take all the jobs.
She does, because she's control. She controls all the jobs.
Don't say that. Anyway, go ahead.
I have to have a badge to get in for recording because I'm not technically allowed to be here.
But now this is your house, so you have to let me in.
Oh my God, she police knocked on my door today, guys.
That's how I knocked.
She knocks like the police. I told her to please use the doorbell in the future.
That's how I knock.
It's aggressive, you guys.
It is firm.
It was like, da, 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 and I was like, good Lord, who is that? And she was like 15 minutes early. So I was like, who is that?
Not the police.
It was not the police.
If I do that next time and say, not the police, is that better?
No, just ring the doorbell.
Did it scare your daughter?
It caught us all a little off guard. I said, there's a doorbell. Please use it. Oh, my goodness. And even the doorbell's a little aggressive because it's like, dong, dong, like it's real loud.
Oh, but I have nothing to do with the doorbell.
I know. I would prefer that to the police knocking, which made me worried that I needed to start hiding
things. Should I do shave and a haircut 2 bits?
Not if you police style it.
No, like. Dong, 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 dong. I did not use my fist, girl.
It sounded like it. Maybe I just have a hollow steel door.
No, I just have strong knuckles. Why are you laughing?
Because now I'm imagining you like dragging them.
Oh gosh, this is way off topic. So anyway, Ian's been arrested for the fourth time. I just can't imagine.
What I was trying to say is the deed of whatever it's called.
Yes, S-A-S-I-N-E.
Yeah, they talk about it being trotted out so many times because they keep bringing it out to prove that
Ian thing's getting ragged.
I'm just like, I'm surprised it lasted until they had photocopy capability to save it and show it to them later in the 60s.
Oh my goodness. She sends Fergus to show them the deed as well as Ian's discharge from his regiment. She says they'll release him again as soon as they realize he isn't the Laird of Lallybroch. And then, quote, precious chance they have of proving a wee bairn to be a traitor, unquote, with a look at young Jamie. But this goes back to what Summer said, is that forethought, all that, to name
a baby
Laird and to deed his property to this like young, like 3-year-old or whatever he was at the time.
Yeah.
My goodness.
Well, if he's 10 now and it's been 7 years.
It hasn't been 7. It's been 6 and a half.
Okay. Well, he is 10 now. So that would make him 3 and a half at
but
the time.
It depends on when the birthday falls, but yeah, right. Approximately.
You're so specific.
Dude, that's my brain. Always keep in mind what Jamie did, what he gave up to save the estate and his people. This deed and what it represents and the English's interest in it, indeed many others, will continue through the entire series. Do you agree?
For sure.
Okay. Joe B. writes, Lallybroch has done somewhat better than other estates due to its location and its former mistress. Claire's potato foresight has saved them from total starvation. Jamie's notoriety brings regular patrols to Lallybroch, as I think so does its relative prosperity if everywhere else there is mass starvation and desolation. Yet the home of Red Jamie Fraser doesn't. I'd be asking some questions, too, if I were the crown. And that's a very good way, you know, because we're such, this is a sound really weird, we're such, Jamie's our hero. Of course we support Jamie. We want him, you know, Jamie and Carr to be together. We root for them all the time. So, of course, we're going to look at those who are anti-Jamie as our enemies or as our, you know, the people we don't want to succeed, at least with hurting the hero that we love. But Joe, that was very astute. Think about it. It's not, do they want to get Jamie back? Of course they want to get Jamie back. But it's not just that. Even if Jamie were dead, I think they would still, they would still be going to Lallybroch trying to mess around. Because,
well, he was a big figure. And
that's the
and
thing.
Anyone who is associated with him would probably also and be a supporter
funny,
of the Jacobite.
How funny is it that his, I almost said plantation, his estate is maybe not thriving, because come on, they're still like not having a lot of food.
Potatoes, all right?
No, but that's what I'm saying.
Potatoes.
Comparatively.
Yeah, because they have potatoes.
Compared with other estates and compared with famine or, you know, starvation, I should say, they've got potatoes. So, I mean, wouldn't you be a little, maybe not suspicious, but it would just attract you is what I'm saying. I think she makes a very good point. When it was time for him to return to his hideout, Diana writes, quote, he would feel it begin to slip away when he left, that thin veneer of humanity, more of it gone with each step away from the farmhouse, unquote. Now, though it was saved, Lallybroch hadn't been unscathed. The English, Diana tells us, had burnt 3 crofts and pulled 2 men from their homes and shot them on their own doorsteps, no questions or formal accusations. The month before, in October, he'd spoken to Fergus and Rabbi McNabb while he was shaving on his visit up to the house. Rabbi was fascinated with all the hair Jamie was shaving off, but Fergus and young Jamie were also intrigued. Young Jamie said he had seen his dad shave himself, but that Jamie had so much hair on his face.
Well, he'd seen his dad shave himself, but he probably shaves himself daily, so it's probably more like taking care of stubble.
That's true.
Whereas, you know, a month's worth of growth. Now, I don't know what a month's worth of growth would look like on Sam Heughan, but I do know that his last...
Episode 7, 207,
where the bush beard. Yeah, where his pubes, his facial pubes.
Bush is actually... same intention, same meaning, but I can't say the other one.
I said it for you. But that's what I heard about online, so I'm kind of interested to see...
As you heard about online...
I've seen a lot of people talking about the fact that it looked like pubes on
okay.
his face.
Okay, got it.
That's what I'm talking about.
Okay, got it.
Anyway.
So I'm not the only one.
No.
Okay, good.
Your tote's not the only one. I'm excited to see what they go with. What a month's worth of growth. Because I don't know how long he was in the Bastille that had, you know, bushed out.
From the day he, if it was the same time. Oh, I think it was. From the day he was taken in. So mm-hmm. the day she gave birth or yes. lost the baby.
Right.
Which was May, I think. But I don't even know the timeline of the book. It's all messed up from the book. Let's just say it's May, whatever. A month or two? At least.
So, but for him to have a fantastically scraggly beard in a month, enough that it's a noticeable thing. I'm just looking forward to the hipster beard. I don't know. I don't know what it's going to look like. I don't know what they're going to end up with, but I'm kind of...
Who's hipster beard?
Have you not seen hipsters? Hipsters have like gigantic beards.
Like...
I don't know. I'm just wondering if it's going to be bigger than the last one.
I can't think of the name. What's the group that people
ZZ Top? No.
No, that follow along their little...
Deadheads?
Yeah, the Dead, Grateful Dead. Like those kind of beards? Like Willie Nelson?
No, I don't think it'll be that long. It's okay. A month, guys. It's not like...
No, I don't mean a month. I mean, is that what
a lifetime beard.
Is that a hipster beard?
No.
Okay. That's a committed beard.
That's a lazy AF beard.
Summer. Jamie realized they must see him as a terribly romantic figure, hiding out in a cave, returning once a month under the cover of night, etc. Connie S. writes, Jamie realizes he's become a legendary mythic figure to the children. They have no understanding of his chronic fear and loneliness. Jamie tells the children, quote, man is born to sorrow and whiskers, one of the plagues of Adam. And when Fergus expresses puzzlement, D.G. writes, quote, Fergus, as a Frenchie, was not expected to know everything, unquote. As he tells the boys about Adam's plague and how hairless they both were, Adam and Eve, young Amy.
Nope.
Young Jamie's eyes flick over to Rabbi's crotch. Because that's what I do when someone's talking to me and I'm standing next to a friend. I know the conversation was about hair, body hair, but still, I would never flash my eyes to a friend's hoo-ha area. Summer!
It was topical.
I had to do it.
For those of you listening in response to all of that, I very pointedly dropped my head to the side and stared right at her crotch just to see what she would do. And she immediately got real uncomfortable. So like I said before, poor Rabbi. Nobody likes that.
You're a nut. Rabbi says, surely you don't have the... Sorry, you don't have... But Rabbi says, surely you don't shave the other hair. Jamie says, no. Then Fergus asks about ladies. And Fergus's voice is also breaking. So we remember Fergus is like 15 now.
Isn't he 16?
He's an old dude.
There's a 15, a 16-year-old, and a 10-year-old.
Wasn't he 10?
So no, it's no. either...
Wasn't he 10 in Paris?
Ferris Bueller's Day Off?
Yes.
I guess. He was I don't 10 know. 11. My point is Rabbi, one of them is 16, one is 15, and one is 10. 10 is Jamie's, young Jamie.
The young one.
And then Rabbi and Fergus are the 15 and 16
I think Fergus is the oldest. I mean, the older.
It's very possible.
Fergus tells them that though women have hair down there too, they don't always normally shave it. Jamie says of women, that's not a curse. That's for a gentleman to find his way safe home. Martina P. I'm like, Summer, you're already home. You don't need to look there. Martina P. writes, such wonderful sense of humor. that Jamie admiringly never loses, even when he finds himself in dire straits. I laughed out loud during Jamie's description of the arrow guiding the man home. Just priceless. And then he feels shame at what he'd said, Jamie does, seeing Jenny
but
again.
But he only felt bad. Like, he would not have felt shame if she hadn't walked in.
Or if she hadn't been pregnant, probably. Well, that's true, if she hadn't come in. So then he feels shame at what he'd said, seeing Jenny, again heavily pregnant, coming toward them. She's bringing him his meal. He cuts a large piece of the savory to give her to eat. And normally she would say, you know, no, this is for you. But he convinces her to eat more for the babe. Lisa T. writes, this passage reminds us also that Brianna has found the legend of the Dunbonnet. She, too, may see Jamie as the boys do. Lisa continues, we then learn of some of the things that Jamie brings when he does come to Lallybroch. One that struck me is the plover's eggs. It reminds me of Jamie's story in Outlander about the plover's cry being that of a young woman dead in childbirth. This is so pertinent as he lost Claire when she was pregnant, and his sister Jamie. And his sister Jenny is pregnant. Connie S. writes, Jamie has been responsible for providing most of the meat for not only the extended Murray Fraser household, but also for the families of the murdered Kirby and Murray. He carries enormous burdens of guilt, fear, and responsibility for the welfare of all of the tenants and inhabitants at Lallybroch. And now we're back to November. He's tracking. His sense of smell had improved immensely since living outdoors. Connie S. writes, Jamie is hunting under a mackerel sky, common terms for a sky with rows of cirrocumulus or altocumulus clouds, displaying an undulating, rippling pattern similar in appearance to fish scales. His is caused by altitude atmospheric waves. His is caused by high altitude atmospheric waves. And we'll include Connie's link to Wikipedia for mackerel sky. Also, she says, the old rhymes, quote, mackerel sky, not 24 hours dry, and mare's tails and mackerel scales make lofty ships to carry low sails, both refer to this long recognized phenomenon. Other phrases in weather lore take mackerel skies as a sign of changeable weather. Examples include mackerel sky, never long wet and never long dry, and a dappled sky like a painted woman soon changes its face. So Jamie is tracking a stag. He sees one, takes the right shot with his arrow, and brings it down. When he goes to slit its throat, he says an old prayer he learned, the Gralach, over it. Diana references his father, Brian's, reaction, and that the god whom the Gralach is prayed to wasn't the same one that they worshipped on Sundays. Mm-hmm. He cups his hand into it, into the deer, that is, and brings up blood to his mouth. He drinks the blood.
Burp.
The transformation from civilized human to animal in hiding is complete. Ellen G. writes, not going to be in the show, I fear. You never know, but probably not. Connie S. writes, Gralach means the viscera of a dead deer as a noun, and the verb means to disembowel a deer that has been shot.
I would like to say that this entire scene made me think of Braveheart.
It made me think.
It's like he drew and quartered that deer.
It made me think of
Monsieur Ferrand.
Twilight.
It made me think of Monsieur Ferrand.
Twilight.
No.
I'm telling you.
Why? Because of the, because she
him.
Ate deer?
No, no. Edward.
Okay. Well, this made me think of
Monsieur Ferrand. I heard
Monsieur
you.
Monsieur Ferrand. Because his description of how to skillfully draw and quarter somebody without, like, he's killing, like, well, you right do this away. And then you don't, if you don't pierce the sack, and it was like, you know, oh, you yeah. do that, you remove all the intestines still in the sack intact. So it very much reminded me of a drawing and quartering.
According to the wildernesshunter.net, and this is again shared by Connie, Gralach is an old Scots term meaning to remove the offal from an animal. Long before Christianity reached the Isles, it became custom to say a quick prayer of thanksgiving when butchering an animal, either wild or homegrown. This became known as the Gralach prayer and was an intensely personal moment for the hunter, and a great many cultures held a similar ritual. For American Indians, the heart, or Native Americans, the heart is the seat of the soul and is buried or burned to allow the spirit of the animal to escape its earthly body. In Germany, this is a time meant to contemplate the complex mixture of elation and sadness that comes with killing any animal. A downed deer is laid on its right side with a small branch of fir or oak, known as der letzte Biss, the last bite, placed in its mouth as a mark of respect. A second branch is placed on the deer to show that the hunter has assumed ownership of the dead animal. Hunters who follow all the appropriate rules and traditions of the hunt are presented with a shooter's branch, which is worn in the left side of the hat band until sunset on the day of the kill. So after Jamie is breathing deeply again, the cold air returns to his skin. He is no longer lost in the warmth in the blood of the stag. He is back to working on the carcass. He removes the digestive tract. And this is where he made the mention of a cut above and below, mm-hmm. right? That's like the cutting of the, I believe, from the esophagus down to the lower colon, because that would include the sac. Connie S. writes, a slash above and other below, and the mass slid free, the transformation of black magic that changed a deer to meat, unquote. This reminds me, she says, of the movie Temple Grandin and her contemplation of when a cow goes from life to death, from animal to beef. Now, the stag was somewhat small, and he believed he would be able to carry it. Diana describes him, quote, the moon cast his shadow on a rock, humped and fantastic, unquote. Another description of him, utterly inhuman. Quote, the deer's antlers bobbed above his shoulder, giving him in shadowed profile the semblance of a horned man, unquote. This is an allusion to the horned god of Celtic mythology, Cernunnos. Diana, through Jamie, quote, he shivered slightly at the thought, remembering tales of witches' sabbats where the horned one came to drink the sacrifice of goat's or rooster's blood, unquote. Connie S., writes, when Jamie hefts the stag onto his shoulders, he casts a shadow with the antlers. This also reminds me of something primitive, not quite civilized, like shamans who would wear antlers, as shown in a drawing at this site. And we'll share the link. It's to gorillaarchaeology.wordpress.com. Antlers and horns, she continues, are another common symbol primarily found on headdresses. Antlers may have symbolized a connection with the deer species and with hunting, but it may also have been used to connect with the wider universe, reaching out into the cosmos from the top of the head like antennae. Like the life tree, the branches of the antlers stretch out into the upper world, becoming channels for messages from higher spirits and levels. So as he approaches the house, his mind becomes more fragmented as he changes from hiding human slash animal to civilized human. Here are the comparisons Diana uses. Day, a creature of the mind, alone. Night, all sense fled. He was ruled by senses. So isn't that funny? Sense fled, but he was ruled by senses. That's just a linguistic thing right there. But I thought it was a nice play on the word sense and senses. Mm-hmm. What a difference an S makes, and the difference is blood.
Nope.
Yep.
I'm going to be anti what you just did. Let's not do that anymore.
I won't do it again.
Thank you.
But I'll leave it there. Continued, he emerged like a beast from its lair to run, hunt, driven by hunger, drunk with blood and moonlight. Look into the light, Carol Ann. Quote, it was only as the lights of Lallybroch Manor came into view that he felt, at last, the mantle of humanity fall upon him, as mind and body joined as one again, as he prepared himself to greet his family. Unquote. Lisa T. writes, in his own way, he is an outlander.
He is. Stranger in a strange land.
Eileen P. writes, what struck me most about the 7 years Jamie lived in the cave is that he is both civilized and feral. While in the cave, he is contemplative, reading books and meditating. By doing so, he expands his mind and eases the stress of his circumstances, enabling himself to tune out his surroundings. He uses his mind to survive. Yet at night, when he emerges from his lair, he is at once feral. He hunts with animal instincts. In fact, those instincts become more acute over the years, his senses heightened. Outside at night, he uses his body to survive. While the description of his life in the cave by day and outside in the dark hills at night demonstrates great coping mechanisms, I think it is his monthly return to Lallybroch that increases his chance of survival. The act of shaving, sitting down to a meal, and especially a conversation with his family makes him human again. Not just cerebral, not just feral, but human. He even thinks of himself as a creature until he becomes human again at Lallybroch. Jamie survives these 7 years because he adapts to his days in the cave and nights hunting, and he has a support and monthly interaction with his family. Now, one thing Eileen P. did say was the description of his time during the daylight hours. We haven't gotten that yet, right?
Mm-hmm.
We have.
No, we don't know what goes on in the cave. We haven't discussed what he does in the cave at this
point. But I'm okay with leaving that because, again, it's not a spoiler, really. of an event. It's a description, what he does during days, which we will come. I'm not sure if it's the next chapter or what, but it's coming up. So that was four.
That was chapter four of Voyager. Again, my favorite book in the series so far. She might write the next one she writes might be my favorite. We'll see.
Two more chances.
She has two more chances, Diana. Two more chances to top Voyager for me. So join us next week when we discuss chapter five, entitled To Us a Child is Given.
It's a very Christmassy title. And To Us a Child is Born. There's like some Christmas carol that's called that or something like that. So what do you think?
I don't think it's a Christmas carol. I'm pretty sure that's in the Bible.
No, I mean, there's a song. Oh, you're right. It's biblical. Biblical stuff. A lot of biblical stuff ends up in carols. Well, Christmassy biblical stuff. So what did you think of chapter four?
It was short. It was delightfully short. Considering,
get ready.
I know. The next one I hear is much longer.
It's 16 pages.
16 pages. I can do it. I got time. I got a week.
I'll try and do it.
It was a good chapter. I think it's kind of easing us back into the Jamie stuff. Because, you know, we kind of started with in your face, Jamie at Culloden stuff. And then we
skipped forward 7 years almost.
Exactly. And got a taste of the 60s again. And
that's kind of how it is. It's skipping time. And then you get a really heavily descriptive account of something at that new place he's at, which has already been for a little bit.
And what Diana does so well, in my opinion, with these books that are two-tiered, because you have two storylines going on concurrently but in different time periods, is that you get so involved in the time period you're in that you have that moment where you're like, no, I don't want to go back. And then you start reading the other time period and you get all into that and engrossed. And then all of a sudden you hit the end of it and they put you back in the other one. You're like, no, I don't want to go back. So it's like each of them, even though you get so engrossed and involved in what's going on and you don't want to leave it, you get to go into something else that's equally engrossing and involved, and then you don't want to leave it. But, you know, it's just this constant back and forth. But she does a really good job with that. I've read a lot of books where they have multiple storylines going on in the same space, and there are some storylines that I don't care about. I just don't care about, to the point that I'm like, okay, I'm reading this. I'm rage reading this section because I just want to get back to the people that I care about. So Diana, like I said, does a really good job with this. Because you care enough about these both stories and they're both so enthralling that you don't want to leave them, but you know that you're leaving them for something that is going to be equally as amazing. So,
and you know, since the end of book two, that there is one and only one goal at this point, at least in Voyager. And that even though they're separated, and even though we're skipping times, not back, but skipping back in time, but going forward in both timelines, I should say, as Summer said, we don't want to leave it, but we know that we're leaving to go to something else. And that something else going forward, both of them, is bringing us to the something, something that everybody wants since the beginning of DIA.
Right?
So what she's basically saying is we're okay with it.
We are.
So that was this week. As Summer said, we invite you to join us on Facebook to continue the conversation. Again, that's outlanderpod.com/group. If your fancy has been tickled or something outlanderish has been tickled.
Unintentional, I promise.
You know, by any episode, by this one, by our episode discussions, by any other read along, anything, we would be so honored if you would take a moment, if you could take a moment to leave us a review in iTunes. And the reason is not just because we would love to hear from you in that manner, but that also helps other people find us. Because when they're searching for podcasts about a certain topic, things will bump up someone's search results to be able to find them. So if you could leave us a review, if you feel so moved, we would be honored. So thank you as always so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous audio host, audioboom.com. Our audioboom channel is www.audioboom.com/channel/outlanderpod. Visit our website at www.outlanderpod.com. Follow us on Twitter at @outlanderpod. Find us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/outlanderpod or email us at outlanderpod@gmail.com.